This episode of the YGK podcast is brought to you by Braintree V.0, the snippet of code that lets you accept PayPal, Apple Pay, and credit and debit cards in your mobile app or website, all with a single integration. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/wired news. Coming up today, fair emoji representation for women, big changes at the BBC, and Hyperloop takes one teeny tiny zoom towards becoming reality. You're listening to episode 267 of the YGK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Emily Reynolds.
Hello.
And Matt Burgess.
Good day.
Friday the 13th, guys.
Unlucky.
We've managed to avoid peril so far. Is it like April Fool's? Does it end at midday?
I don't think so. I think it's always unlucky.
It's just unlucky for the whole day. So, touch wood, we'll all be fine. Okay, Matt, a thing you learned this week.
I've learned that when the Victoria Line was built, a proposed name was the Viking Line.
Do you know why?
Nope, not a clue.
Fantastic. All right, let's move swiftly on. Emily, what did you learn this week?
I learned that in the 1940s, there was a chicken who lived for 18 months after his entire head had been cut off.
Okay.
It sounds fake, but it is actually true.
It's a true fact.
When he went to, a farmer went to cut off the head of his chicken to presumably eat it, the axe removed most of his head, but left his brainstem and jugular intact.
And that chicken had a name.
His name was Mike the Headless Chicken.
It's a good name. So, descriptive.
Yeah, it to the point.
And there's quite a bit on the internet about Mike the Headless Chicken. He's something of a curiosity.
Yeah, fan fiction.
Yeah.
Memes.
So go check that out. This week, I learned that there are 21 different wolf dialects, according to a team of Cambridge zoologists. So the team listened to more than 2,000 wolf howls and categorise them based on pitch, volume and modulation. So not all wolves are the same. And I feel that that's kind of in keeping with the Friday the 13th theme.
I think mine is too, because it's kind of gory and weird.
Yeah,
whereas... Sony Matt Burgess has let us down.
Poorly researched.
Vikings are pretty scary.
I guess, yeah. A horde of Vikings, fine. You can have that. Emily, our first story this week is all about emoji.
Yes, so a team at Google have proposed a whole new set of emoji depicting professional women.
Why?
Well, they say that it will kind of increase representation of women in emoji.
So this is a problem, right? There aren't enough good professional female emoji in the set that we currently have.
Yeah, so if you look at the emoji, most of the female emojis are things like princesses and dancing ladies and things. And the team say that most of the people who use emoji are young women, so they should be seeing better representation of themselves.
So what are these new emoji that they've proposed to replace these?
Okay, so they've proposed emoji in 7 categories. Farming, which is like a little lady holding a pitchfork. Industry, healthcare, technology, business, education, food service, and a rock star.
Aspirational rock star.
Yeah, that's what it was, an aspirational rock star. So it looks a bit like David Bowie.
What happens next? Google has proposed them, but they don't just suddenly appear. There's a process.
Yeah, so they've proposed them, and then Unicode, who are obviously in charge of the emoji keyboard, are likely to consider it. But previously they've introduced like racially diverse emoji, so it's something that could happen.
And let's just say that they don't seem to be particularly fussy about the emoji that they let in. So it would be ridiculous if these emoji weren't let in based on what already exists. So we've got things like a smiling pile of poo.
Yep.
And
there's some money with wings.
Money with wings.
Aubergine.
Aubergine.
That's very useful.
Yeah, apparently, as we found out this week. Well, as I found out this week. Yeah, so it seems pretty likely to happen.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
And needs to happen, do you think?
Yeah, well, I don't think the emoji keyboard is kind of the battleground for the greatest feminist debates of our time. But, I mean, it's nice for young women to be able to see themselves represented.
Matt, another news story this week. The BBC Charter review by the government had an awful lot in it. We've picked out some of the key points for Wired readers and listeners. Tell us some more.
So the government's charter review of the BBC actually was published this week, and it's been a long time in the making, and it's really just going to redefine how the BBC moves forward in the next decade, basically.
So very briefly, what is the BBC charter and why is it being reviewed?
So the BBC Charter is a document that basically underpins everything that the BBC does. It sets out the purpose of the BBC, says that it's independent, even though funded by government. It outlines what the BBC Trust is and the executive board and what everything should be happening by the BBC. It basically is everything that the BBC does.
Okay, and the current charter, which is fairly old now, runs out on the 31st of December this year. So it's high time for a new one. What has been proposed?
So in the build-up to the actual charter running out, there's been a government review led by John Whittingdale, the Culture Secretary, and he has got a team of people together and produced a big long report which covers everything from stars being paid to the licence fee. So it's a really long, detailed report, and some of the biggest things, and probably the best one to start with, is the BBC Trust, which was the body, the governing body of the BBC, and one of its main roles was to look at complaints received about broadcasting, and this has been abolished. So if you want to make a complaint about the BBC in the future, you will have to go to Ofcom, which is the communications regulator, and covers all other broadcasting regulations at the moment.
So the BBC will fall under the same regulator as Channel 4, Channel 5, ITV, Sky, you name it. It will be regulated by the same body. Did they give a reason for why this was a good idea?
I think it's just in general to move everything into streamlined and actually make sure that the BBC is covered in the same way that other broadcasters are, rather than doing a self-regulatory model, really.
Okay, and another really significant proposed change was around the BBC iPlayer. Can you explain what the iPlayer loophole, because this was a phrase that kept coming up when this news came out. What is that?
Okay, so when, James, when you watch TV, do you watch it on TV, or are you somebody who watches a lot of catch-up streaming stuff?
Bits and bobs, but I can kind of see where your question's going. So I've got a Netflix account, an Amazon account, and watched lots of stuff on BBC iPlayer, and occasionally some live broadcasts. But I think, like a lot of people, sort of 40 and under, a lot of my TV is catch-up.
Yeah, Emily, are you the same?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, so the BBC and this government review has actually realised this, and it's, at the moment, if you watch iPlayer and you just watch it as a catch-up service, so nothing that is being streamed live to the internet from the BBC, you don't have to have a licence fee. So if you're watching Doctor Who or any of the shows in the UK from the BBC on iPlayer, you don't have to have a TV licence to do so. And basically, this review has said that this is a loophole. This content is being created by the BBC and other producers and people who are watching it, and as more people go into watching just catch-up TV and not stuff that's being broadcast live, the people that are watching it on catch-up aren't actually paying for it.
And when the current BBC charter was drawn up, these kind of things weren't issues. BBC iPlayer is a relatively recent innovation and a brilliant one. And I think its popularity has led the government to say, hey, well, this is silly. There are a lot of people, particularly young people, that just rely on catch-up TV and never watch broadcast TV at all. Things like moving BBC Three online only is a sign that the BBC recognises that and is changing the way it operates. So it could mean that particularly a lot of students, amongst who this is apparently very popular, will end up paying the £145.50 licence fee. And there was some news on the actual amount that the licence fee will be over the coming years as well.
Since 2010, it's actually been frozen at that £145.50 that you just mentioned. But going forward, it's actually going to increase with inflation for the next 5 years from 2017. So the licence fee will be going up, and it hasn't done for a while. But this is a proposal that they decided is the best sort of way to still fund the BBC, because there were suggestions that there should be other funding models in place. But the review has actually decided that the licence fee is still the best one at the moment.
And the Charter Review also covered what the BBC produces or should be seen to produce.
Yeah, so it covers all of the gubbins to do with the regulatory aspects of the BBC, but also the content and actually things that are being produced and that we will watch and consume as consumers. So the review said that the BBC must focus on high-quality programmes and not ratings. There must be more educational content, more outsourcing of production, so less stuff being made by the BBC, although it should be said that that's not including news. News stays thoroughly with the BBC. And people that and staff that are paid more than £450,000 a year will have their salaries published, and there should be more diversity of the actual production of the content as well.
Yeah, and stricter auditing of the BBC brought under the auspices of the National Audit Office. And on your final point of diversity at the BBC, there was a very, very clear section of the Charter Review that said the BBC needed to focus more on Black, Asian and other ethnic minority content and presenters and representation. So that would be something to definitely keep an eye out on. One last thing, Matt, how long will this new charter cover? How many years?
So it'll cover 11 years, which is quite a long time, but it's been moved slightly so it doesn't coincide with election periods and around election times. So the political angle is taken out of it, but there's going to be a review, sort of a halfway review in 5 or 6 years, just to see if everything's working and make some small amendments, basically. But this is something that is going to go through Parliament. There will be debates and discussion around what actually gets passed. So this is sort of what's come out, but what we do see in a few months' time before next year, maybe slightly different.
So these are proposals for the time being. And if you want a more thorough rundown of what was in the BBC Charter Review, you can check out the story on wired.co.uk/BBC. The story I was looking at quite a bit this week is all around Hyperloop, the super futuristic transportation technology, which has been successfully tested for the first time. An electromagnetically propelled sled reached 187 kilometers per hour during a short open-air test before ploughing into a pile of sand. Sand, because it didn't have any brakes.
That all sounds pretty high-tech. So how significant is this test?
Well, I mean, 187 kilometers an hour isn't that fast, but for something that's being propelled electromagnetically in technology that has never really been developed before now, it is significant. So the test lasted a few seconds and was the first demonstration of a much-hyped transportation technology. There's been a lot written about Hyperloop, a lot said about Hyperloop. It was carried out by Hyperloop One, which is one of a handful of startups working on competing and slightly different Hyperloop systems. And one day, this is the really cool bit, the technology has theorized speeds of 745 miles an hour, that's 1200 kilometers per hour, or as Hyperloop One has promised, surface speeds in excess of 300 meters a second, which is just over 1000 kilometers per hour. So it's, you know, it's up to the speed of a plane and beyond.
That sounds quite terrifying to be inside, frankly.
Yes.
How does it actually work then?
Well, it's electromagnetic. So there's a series of different technologies that are being developed. When Elon Musk, who's SpaceX, he's Tesla CEO and SpaceX CEO, when he first proposed this idea, I think back in 2012, 2013, he decided that it was too big a project for him and his companies alone to work on. So he open sourced the documents around it in 2013. And since then, lots of different companies have been working on the idea. But the principle is that you have tubes which are vacuum sealed potentially, and through those tubes at incredibly high speeds pass floating, levitating pods.
And this is an idea that was actually when Musk did first propose this, he did say it would go across California, is that correct?
Yeah, so as anyone who's ever visited the United States or Canada will know, there's a lot of rail networks out there, but most of them are used to ship freight, and passenger services are incredibly limited or incredibly slow or incredibly expensive. People in the US and Canada, simply because the countries are so big, get about by flying. Planes are like buses. Whereas in Europe, we get around by train and by bus and by car, and there's less flying unless you're going from one country to another. So it's quite a North American problem that it's addressing. So the theory is that it could go from San Francisco to Los Angeles, which is a very popular flying route on the West Coast, in 35 minutes.
That's
and you'd be able to take it from city centre to city centre.
So what would that be in the UK, for example?
Yeah, so there's been some proposals in the UK. There's another Hyperloop company called Hyperloop Transportation Technologies, which is a US-based group of engineers, and they recently announced the exclusive acquisition of a license to use a new passive magnetic levitation technology in its system, which is different to the one that Hyperloop One tested earlier this week. And they've spoken about plans for the UK or proposals for the UK. And they claimed that a route from London to Glasgow, which at the moment takes, I think, about 6 hours on the train, would cost £5.2 billion to construct a Hyperloop track between the two, but reduce journey times to 30 minutes, which is quicker than you can fly.
That's the amount of time it takes for me to get to work in the morning.
Yeah, from West London to Central London.
Yeah, so yeah. That's pretty impressive.
What I don't quite understand, and what I've not read anything that explains it well, is what it feels like to ride inside one of these. So the first tests with humans should be in the next year or so, potentially, but they're going to run at much slower speeds. And I guess eventually they'll crank them up to closer to the full speed. But surely you'd feel something similar to the G of a Formula One car, or more than, no matter how much they can reduce it by, you're still going at 700 miles an hour. That's going to have some sort of sensation on your body.
It must have some sort of sensation, but I don't know the actual physics behind how this would work. But would it, the difference being in a non-pressurized tube, would that take away some of that G-force if this pod was going through a tube with no pressure? And would you not feel it?
That's part of the major engineering challenge and why Hyperloop tracks could be very, very expensive to build, is because building vacuum tubes and levitating systems over those kind of distances and maintaining those speeds safely is really, really difficult. And another interesting thing about the technology is it can only really go in straight lines. So in America, famous for very long straight roads, same in Canada, there are roads that go for thousands of miles all across these countries. And the Hyperloop tracks would act in a very similar way. They would just arrow straight across the United States. And there have been proposals for Hyperloop networks that would cover the entire continental United States and Canada. So there's also a Canadian company, I should say, whose name escapes me. What is it called?
Transpod.
Thank you. You can see my notes quicker than me. So in Canada, Transpod, they're based in Toronto, and they plan to present a full-scale Hyperloop concept vehicle at this year's InnoTrains rail show in Berlin. So while recently Hyperloop might have seemed quite far away, there's a lot of money being invested in it. Hyperloop One recently received an extra $80 million in funding. And now, for the first time, we've seen a very basic demonstration of what it could be. Exciting?
I'm excited. I think that it's going to be something that could change how people travel over long distances. There are a lot of hurdles to actually overcome, but for people to take this idea, which was open source, made available to anybody, and have multiple teams working on it, then there's got to be some sort of future there if so many people see an actual application that would work.
Yeah. Emily?
I'd use it. Sounds great.
So long as it doesn't make your organs go all squiffy.
Yeah, that would be a drawback.
The thing that Hyperloop always reminds me of is those tubes they have in supermarkets where they put the cash in and then send it all the way around the shop.
Like internal mail systems.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
Yeah, which works on a vacuum as well.
Or Augustus Gloop in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Right, or the Futurama tubes in Futurama.
We're just naming tubes now.
Pretty much, yeah. And I think that a certain level of scepticism is required, because I'm a bit of a fan of hovercrafts, right? And you used to be able to get hovercrafts that would go from from England to France. So you could get very long distance, huge hovercrafts that carry cars, etc. The only commercial hovercraft I think that still operates in the UK goes from just outside Portsmouth to the Isle of Wight, and they've been massively scaled back. And it was thought that hovercrafts were going to be the future of high-speed travel over water. And that ended up being a bit of a false dawn, and there were hover trains that were proposed and all sorts of crazy things. So every so often there is this amazing new transportation revolution that comes along. Maybe at the moment it's easy to overhype things. The actual difficulties in getting this technology to be viable and usable and profitable, that seems incredibly difficult and a long way off to me. Anyway, still to come. Earlier this week, a report claimed Facebook's trending news bar was regularly edited to remove right-wing news and make sure that politics took precedent over panda pics. Facebook has denied the allegations to an extent, but what's actually wrong with Facebook influencing what people see? We'll discuss that after this.
Mobile app development can be complex, but integrating your payments no longer has to be. With Braintree, your business can accept nearly every type of payment from any device with just one integration. Everything from Pesos to PayPal to Apple Pay to whatever comes next. Braintree's simple, flexible SDKs make your job and payments easier. Learn more at braintreepayments.com/wired news.
Welcome back. Matt, Emily, how much do you trust what you read on Facebook?
It depends who's posting it for me. If it's my mum, probably not. No, she's all right on there. But we've all got friends that we may not trust what they say. And if it's a news organisation, maybe a bit more.
Yeah, it depends on who you follow and how the news feed displays it. Emily?
Yeah, I'd pretty much agree. It's basically who has posted it, what their political affiliations are, and also the source of what they're posting as well.
Yeah, so it's not this perfect newspaper-like presentation. Well, even newspapers aren't perfect, but it's a really mixed bag.
Yeah.
So earlier this week, on Monday in fact, Gizmodo reported that former Facebook workers claim to have routinely suppressed conservative news from the social network's trending news section. Stories suppressed included ones about right-wing gatherings, Mitt Romney, and Rand Paul. Even though these topics were trending among the site's users at the time, the former Facebook employees claim that these stories and others didn't make it onto the trending topic sidebar. We should say the trending topic sidebar is a thing that you see kind of towards the top of Facebook on the right-hand side of the newsfeed that will have the biggest news that day as decided by Facebook. People had presumed that that was being generated by an algorithm, but documents leaked by The Guardian, the claims made to Gizmodo, and things that Facebook has shared since show that that isn't necessarily the case. Several former Facebook staffers also told Gizmodo that news curators at the social network were instructed to inject selected stories into the trending module, even if they weren't popular enough to be included. In short, Facebook's news operation works just like any other newsroom, complete with biases and political, social, and moral motivations. My question is, does this matter?
I'm saying yes, I think it does matter. Because if Facebook has made a conscious decision to highlight stories to people, then they should there should be clear guidelines on what they do and how they do it, and everything that they do to highlight certain stories should be publicly available and should be publicly documented, which it is sort of now that they've revealed some documents, but we'll come on to that in a few minutes. But yeah. I think that if there is going to be a policy of having certain news stories directed at people, they should be telling us how they're doing it.
So the difference here is, to take the Daily Mail or the Guardian as an example, people know that those publications have political affiliations and that they have editors who decide what appears on the homepage, what stories they cover, and what they give prominence to. Whereas the trending topics sidebar was thought to be generated by an algorithm. So the lack of openness and transparency in how Facebook was operating that sidebar, it may seem like an insignificant thing, but that's how a lot of people get their news, and that's caused problems. Emily, what do you think?
I pretty much agree with Matt, which is kind of boring. I probably see less of a problem with kind of the idea that they were injecting. I mean, one of the problems that people were saying, you know, like right when commentators were annoyed that Facebook were kind of promoting issues like Black Lives Matter in their sidebar rather than conservative things, I have less of a problem with that because I am kind of pro, you know, news organizations, etc., bringing prominence to things that are kind of going viral on elsewhere on social media.
Like, so Twitter. To take the counter view, these were things that weren't trending on Facebook that were often injected into the news feed, into the trending topics sidebar. And the kind of inference that you can take from this is an awful lot of the discussion on Facebook is quite cutesy. It's all based around the idea of liking things, so it will be cat pictures, panda pictures, these kind of things, silly little videos.
Yeah.
And Facebook doesn't want to be seen to be that kind of organisation. So whereas it's maybe okay for it to present a political view and be transparent about that, but to try and represent itself as a more serious news organisation than it actually is, seems a bit duff.
Well, I know that Facebook are kind of trying to move towards that. I know Mark Zuckerberg has said, in terms of things like instant articles and stuff that they've introduced, that they're kind of moving towards being a source of news for people, so people will come on Facebook to get their news. So I guess it's all part of that wider thing.
Yeah. The thing that I was thinking about around this is that, so people presumed that this trending topic sidebar was being put together by an algorithm. And they thought that in some way that would be preferable to it being curated by human beings. But the algorithm, think back, was created by human beings if it were to exist. So it's like saying that it's preferable for Google to tell you the most relevant results to something rather than for a team of human beings to come back and get you that most relevant result. So the same biases and stereotypes and whatever it may be would still be present in the algorithm because the algorithm was made by human beings in the first place, right?
Yeah, and they also reflect other societal opinions and stereotypes and stuff. So.
Yeah, the algorithm is just a computer that's been told to think almost like a human. A good example of this, a Google image search for professional hair will show images of pretty much all white women, while a search for unprofessional hair will show images of just Black women. At the time, Google said that this was a fundamental societal problem and that there was a persistent and problematic biases which were simply just being represented by its search algorithms. So even if Facebook's trending topic sidebar was put together by an algorithm, it would still have these problems. It would have the biases of its creators.
Yeah, it would perpetuate things that were already existing.
Yeah.
For me, when you say trending, I always think to Twitter and what's trending there, and that in as far as I know, is done based on the most amount of tweets about a topic or using a hashtag or things that have grown very quickly. And when you say trending, to me, that means that something is being shared a lot of times. Now, when you come to Facebook, it's maybe slightly different, but I think the aim behind this was to try and do topics, which it's very hard to say a certain topic if Facebook isn't very big on hashtags. So it's very hard to say a certain topic is being actually shared or talked about a lot.
Yeah, so maybe it's a problem with mislabeling. It's less trending topics and maybe more top news. Because on Twitter, if you look at those trending topics, they're often, not to be mean, but kind of vacuous or about a sports match that's going on, because that will attract an awful lot of tweets in a very short space of time. Whereas Facebook was maybe purporting to do something a bit different. For its part, it said that it has rigorous guidelines in place to ensure that trending topics had consistency and neutrality. Quote, the topics you see are based on a number of factors, including engagement, timeliness, pages you've liked, and your location, Facebook explained. But one former Facebook staffer told Gizmodo that it was absolutely biased. We were doing it subjectively. It just depends on who the curator is and what time of day it is, which is dodgy.
I would argue that if Facebook want to have a particular kind of editorial stance, and I know like Mark Zuckerberg personally is very much in favor of promoting social issues within the company, and you know he's made moves to make the company more diverse, etc., then that's fine, but that they should be clearer about it. And you know, it says it depends on who the curator is. Maybe they should have kind of hardline editorial stance.
Yeah.
Then is applied, you know, more widely.
And at the end of the day, Facebook isn't a news organization. It is a social network where people go to do different things. And if Facebook is saying this is the news that you should be reading, or people are, or is purportedly trending, then they should be very clear about this. But people don't necessarily go to Facebook as a news source. Well, I don't.
I think it's a good thing to raise awareness as well, though, to put a kind of different point forward. I mean, maybe people go on Facebook to look at a picture of like their mate's baby. But I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that while they're there, they may become aware of a kind of social issue that does actually have kind of quite wide political importance, for example, like Black Lives Matter.
So you'd say there should be an inbuilt bias in Facebook's system to promote social issues, to stop people from just looking at funny pictures?
I don't think they have an obligation to, or like a social obligation, but I don't think that there's anything inherently wrong with it.
But in the same way that a newspaper might really focus in on an issue that people wouldn't necessarily care about unless it did, campaign journalism, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is Facebook's role now to do that as well?
I don't know if it has any, I don't know if it should be its role, but like I said, I don't think there's anything wrong with that, them kind of adopting that role.
Yeah. To go back to the openness point, Matt, you wrote a story this morning. Facebook has, since its initial response, actually opened itself up a bit and released some of the documents that show, in fact, it is human beings that are controlling this trending topics bar, not an algorithm.
So the most recent thing that they've done is, it's sort of twofold. Mark Zuckerberg himself has become involved. He put out a statement on his own Facebook page that says there's going to be a full investigation into the claims that any conservative news has been censored. But so far, they haven't actually found any evidence to say it's true, he said. So as well as this, they actually put out these documents, their own internal guidelines, which The Guardian obtained a version of and published first. But now Facebook have put out a more up-to-date version, which has got very little changes in, but to be the most transparent that they can, they put out the documents that say this is how we do our trending news.
Okay, so briefly, how does Facebook define its trending news and how it operates?
So the guidelines confirm that humans are in charge of most of the aspects and different stages of the actual trending topic list. Humans will be highlighted partly from algorithms to news stories that are going on and people are talking about a lot at the time. And there are three human teams that are part of the setup and the organization. And these include an editorial team, a topic detection team, and a topic ranking team. So each story is given a ranking on how important it is and how much people are talking about it. And then these are put into the system by humans who curate the list that appears.
Do we think that these people, without wanting to hammer on at it too much, these people are potentially now more powerful than newspaper editors? They are bigger than Paul Dacre, say, at the Daily Mail. They are bigger than the people running the New York Times and the Washington Post.
Potentially, yeah, which I guess is why it's necessary for them to have the kind of guidelines that we were just talking about.
Yeah, because no one knows who these people are.
Facebook's got more than 1 billion users. That's bigger than any circulation of newspaper or online media at all. So these people should have some openness and transparency about what they do.
Yeah, and they do things to editorialize it. So they'll replace images, they'll rewrite sentences, and they'll select in which order the story should appear, Facebook has revealed. And they'll also make it clear where events happened. And as we've found out, it seems they're selective. What appears is down to them, but also down to algorithms and a set system that Facebook has laid out in part.
And on that level of curation that happens, each story, for example, is given a rating on terms of how much of a news story it is. So the most, the biggest section of stories and the most dramatic stories, I should say, are what Facebook's documents term as holy shit stories. And these are stories that only happens a few times a year. In Facebook's documents, it gives examples of the Charlie Hebdo killings in France last year. And it says that these stories need to fill a certain criteria before they're promoted as a story that is absolutely massive, something that people must read. And the documents explain that the topics have to be covered by 10 leading news organisations and be the most prominent on at least 8 of them.
Right, and just to very quickly reel off those 10 news organisations and see if you can spot a trend here. BBC News, CNN, Fox News, The Guardian, NBC News, New York Times, USA Today, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post and BuzzFeed News. What do they all have in common?
They're all in the Western world?
Yeah, they're all English language, which is surely hugely problematic.
It's putting a bias on anything that happens in the West and any big stories that happen here.
Yeah, which is a common complaint against Facebook when it activates its... Now, what's it called?
Temporary profile pictures.
No, not the temporary profile pictures. The system that it activates when there's been a natural disaster or a shooting to tell people that they're safe, which I can't remember the name off the top of my head. But while it will be activated quite often for events that happen in the West, it's been criticised for not being activated for events in the Middle East, for natural disasters in Asia, whereas it is always activated when something happens in America or Europe. So it's interesting to me that that's the list that it considers to be definitive on what's important in the world.
And that, to say they're the 10 biggest ones that it does see. It does look at other news organisations, but there it's most prominent, it's most relied and trusted upon, I guess.
A billion people live in India. You know, there's not one. It's just a real curiosity. And it seems like Facebook hasn't quite batted this story away yet. It's been trying very hard to suggest that, no, this isn't such a big deal. But it's exposing the importance of Facebook as a news organisation and perhaps how little consideration has been given to how that news organisation operates and how it's held to account. So one final question from me. Will this change how you get your news on Facebook and how you think about what you see on Facebook?
I personally don't get my news from Facebook. I primarily get my news from Twitter, but I will probably think more carefully about the trending topics now when I have a look at them.
I would hope it does change how some people at least see this. Like Emily, I don't actually get much news from Facebook myself, but I know a lot of people that do, a lot of people that are on the site all the time. Just click on news links, a lot of news is shared on Facebook, and if these feed into how the trending topics works, then people should actually understand how the system works. And if it's going out to a billion people a day, then Facebook should publish its guidelines and its proper systems and really consider how much of an impact it can have.
And maybe now there is more transparency around those systems, improve them and take feedback and criticism of those systems from its users, because Facebook is nothing without all of us clicking and tapping on it all day long. Well, that's it for the podcast this week. Any feedback, podcast@wired.co.uk, or you can get us on Twitter @WiredUK or personally @JTemperton.
@MattBurgess1.
@RayZ_Z. It's very embarrassing.
Got to get the spelling right. And we will see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.